This is the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
Precisely. It is. It is just after 1 p.m. on a Saturday, a cold one, but a nice bright one. Lots of time and a good reason to listen to the Disability Law Show here once again. James Fireman and Tamara Gopian, both Sam Firu to Markin LLP, the most positively reviewed disability law firm in this fine land of ours, coast to coast to coast. You want to reach out to either anytime, talk to them or a member of their respectable and very helpful team. Easy. 1-855-821-5900. The number, help at disabilityrights.ca. And any other questions you might have, you want to type them, use your smartphone or whatever, mydisabilityquestions.com. Got lots of stuff to get through today. Topics, emails, questions. So let's get it happening. James, Tamar, hi guys. How are you?
Goals, my friend. How are you, Tamar?
Good to be with you. Good, I'm inside. Who's starting? Who's going to go first?
Well, I have a couple things I wanted to talk about off the top. I'll start with one, and then I'll bounce over to Tamar, and then I'll take it back afterwards. How about that?
So beautiful.
As I always love to be topical and like to take advice from my friends, our pal Terry texted me a couple minutes ago and made a suggestion, which I'm going to take him up on. So when you look at a typical long-term disability policy, there is a section in there about what is not covered. And we don't really often spend a lot of time talking about it, but it is quite appropriate today that we do. So some of the things that you typically see not covered, if you are totally disabled resulting from participation in a criminal offense or intentionally self-inflicted injuries and so forth. But there is another item that is not covered that is particularly appropriate for today, which is if you are totally disabled resulting from the hostile action of any armed forces, insurrection, or participation in a riot or civil commotion. Now, I'm certainly not going to make any pronouncement over whether the convoy is a civil commotion or a riot or any such thing. That's not for me to say, nor am I saying that. But what I can tell you with almost 100% certainty is this. If you are in the convoy and you are injured as a result and you're not able to work, I promise you your insurance company will take that position. That I am sure of. So just something to think about in the back of your mind. Stay safe while you're out there. I have another topic, but I don't want to hog all of the first segment. And so, Tamar, anything that you would like to start us off with?
Such a hog, eh? I appreciate it, James. I appreciate it. Now, look, I do have something, and it's been something I've been working on this week. And I thought we would start off our show talking about it because it really relates to the core idea of what establishes total disability. I have a client. He was involved in a motor vehicle accident, I would say about 10 or 11 years ago, and sustained some very serious injuries. He thankfully recovered from those injuries and did manage to find himself some alternative work and continued working quite productively until I would say about two and a half years ago. And in that time, had a couple of accommodations put in place. He had an office type job, but continued to have typical chronic pain type issues. But what ended up happening a couple of years ago was, on top of the chronic pain issues, were various other, I would say, autoimmune type conditions that exhibited themselves in his body in different ways, primarily resulting in fatigue. So you can understand and appreciate someone who's had chronic pain for a number of years, trying to manage that pain, and then on top of that has some other health issues, and it just became too much. Age was also certainly a factor. And so with his doctor's support, he did start a disability leave, and he was on the path actually with the insurance company for over a year because he went down the road of appealing his decision a number of times and he was never approved. So the insurance company never approved his disability claim. And then naturally, he finally picked up the phone, gave us a call, you know, and of course, we've started a legal claim. And what's interesting about the situation is that one of the issues the insurance company has is, look, he's had these motor vehicle, injuries stemming from this motor vehicle accident, but he managed to work anyway. So we don't think it's severe enough for him to be considered totally disabled. So they resisted accepting that he could not continue working even though he had the medical support from his doctor that not only were his chronic pain issues worsening, he also had the overlay of other health issues. And so this is very typical of insurance companies, because he was already doing what's called a quote-unquote sedentary job. He was already doing a job at a level that usually is the backup option for most insurance companies. And I think the concern was most certainly that if they did approve him, it was likely that he was going to continue to be on claim with them, because they couldn't lean on that backup option to say, okay, look, in a year or two, when the change of definition happens, you can go back to that office job. He was disabled from that office job from the start. And I describe these kinds of disabilities as a constellation of health issues. There are a variety of things that are waxing and waning that put individuals in a situation where they become totally disabled. And so we say this oftentimes on the show, and we assert it in our legal claims against the insurance companies to say, look, it's a combination of things. It doesn't necessarily have to be one thing. And certainly if it's a progressive issue and it's getting worse with time, that also is sufficient to constitute total disability if you've got the medical support in order to do so. So this is the scenario, this is the backdrop, and this is the file that I've been working on. So I'm curious to hear what James has to say about this kind of a scenario. What do you think, James?
Well, I mean, it's certainly an interesting scenario. It's one that comes up a lot. But the part that I think really resonates is where you have someone who is doing their best to continue working, and their employer is doing the right thing, accommodating their disability as far as they reasonably can to allow the employee to continue working. When you have a scenario like that, and subsequently the person just is no longer able to work, if it's something progressive, it's just deteriorating over time, getting worse and worse, and they can't do it anymore, the insurer invariably says, well, you know, nothing's changed. You've been working for the last few years, ignoring the fact that things are getting gradually worse. There doesn't have to be a singular triggering event that significantly or markedly changes things at a moment in time. It can be progressive over years, and often that's the way life works. But the other thing that we see all the time is that the insurers will give themselves the benefit of the accommodations in redefining what that person's occupation is. So that's a lot of words. What I mean by that is, when you are getting accommodations from work, so you start in your job, you're able to do it, and you're injured somehow, and your employer gives you an accommodation so that you can keep working. Well, the insurance company is typically going to try and get away with redefining your employment as the accommodated employment, not what you were originally working as, not your original occupation, but the occupation you're fulfilling with the accommodations. That's not the way it works. Especially if your disability is related to the thing you're being accommodated for in the first place. Your injuries and disabilities can and often are cumulative. As Tamar loves to say, they're a constellation of different things. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you are getting accommodations over some period of time doesn't change the actual nature of your occupation. And if over time, even with the accommodations, you're just not able to do it anymore, it isn't the difference between, you know, what you're able to do now and what you were able to do a month ago in the accommodated position. It's based on what your original occupation is. And that is, by that point, often several years down the road, going to be a very marked difference. But the insurers don't like to accept that. So if that is what the insurer is saying, they're wrong. And you should be fighting them on that. Tamar?
I 100% agree with you, James. And it is a great analysis, but it is also one where, you know, doctors are also hesitant to endorse the idea that you should stop working in a scenario like that. And so, you know, it clearly was a path that this particular client was on for some time, both from a health perspective and with the insurance company, to all the points that James has made. And so absolutely, it is ripe for an opportunity for a legal claim, most certainly. And because of what I think are those other issues. In other words, the insurance company will look at your age, how long is left on the policy, what your occupation was, and if realistically, they can expect that in a year or two, they can try and do what they always do, which is to try and cut off the claim and get you back to work. they will often not include that directly in their analysis. This is why we often pick up the claims file, James and I, and we'll comb through that and read that, because it's underlying sometimes in that analysis, much like James said. And so, you know, in my mind, I don't want to see individuals shying away from the idea of, look, it's just become too much, I need to stop working. That is what disability benefits are for. And if the insurance company is resisting your claim, then by all means, hopefully they'll pick up the phone and give us a call and talk to us about it. So that's one element. The other one that you brought up, James, the one about the exclusion, and I do give Terry a nod for this. You know, there's that section in the policy with those exclusions have a number of different things in them. And one of the other ones that often comes to mind, but we don't often talk about on the show, is the one that says, if you work at any occupation, you're not entitled to benefits at all whatsoever. But maybe this is one we can pick up a little later. But what I was thinking about in this context was, if you have a partial work capacity, or if you've got a secondary job, perhaps a business that you're running from home, but that's not the job that you're claiming total disability from, what is the insurance company going to do? And invariably, they're going to look through their policy and try and find ways to decline the claim. And one of those bases is that exclusion in that group of exclusions, including the riot one and the criminal act one that James mentioned at the top of the show, is also one that says if you work at any occupation, you're not entitled to disability benefits.
Guys, with that, we'll take a short break because it is about that time, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to grab a keyboard, a phone, or whatever, and reach out. You want to talk to James and Tamar for the remainder of the hour. If you have questions about disability law, dealing with an insurance company, appeals, all that stuff, we cover it every Saturday, so feel free to chime in, 416-872-1010, 416-872-1010, to call for text if you prefer. That is 71010 as well, and to reach out through email for the remainder, and any other time for that matter, simply help at disabilityrights.ca. We'll continue. More Disability Law Show is coming right up, right here on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
You're listening to the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
And welcome back. We are just getting warmed up, so you got some time to chime in, ask some questions. We'd love to have you on. 416-872-1010 is the way you call in. You prefer to text, that is 71010 as well. And good old-fashioned email, help@disabilityrights.ca. By the way, any other time when we're not on the show, you have questions about disability, want to learn some stuff, you can go to mydisabilityquestions.com. The database there is searchable, so you can see if your question has been asked. If not, leave it there. Tamar, James, member of the team of the firm, will answer and get back to you, and you'll be that much smarter. Guys, where are we taking this? James, Tamar, it's up to you if you want to continue on with what we were talking about.
Well, let me add something here. First of all, not for nothing, but I think we just had Eminem's Crack a Bottle as our intro music.
Is that what that was?
I think it was. I think it was. That was very well done. What I did want to talk about the other week that was topic that I had brewing,
awesome,
is the concept of inertia as a driving force in decision-making in LTD cases. And we really see this all the time, where insurers will come to a decision, and once they've gotten there, it's really almost impossible to move them off. And this is what is often at play in the appeal process that we talk about all the time. But it can also hold true even before the decision's actually been made to cut off benefits. And so let me give you an example from a recent case. I have a client, and we have a mediation coming up, and she had her father pass away a few years back, and the reaction was much greater than is typically what you would expect. Certainly there was a brief reaction, but she just didn't recover from it. There was severe depression, which developed into anxiety as well, and she was approved for short-term disability benefits and then long-term. So she was actually approved for long-term. It was quite clear that she was not able to work for some period of time, and she was getting LTD for a year or so. And the insurer decided that it was time for her to go back to work, against the advice of her doctors, of course. But nonetheless, they had made that decision that it was time to start planning around returning to work. I don't know whether she would have done it had nothing happened, but what did wind up happening in the midst of this planning was then her mother passed away. And given what had triggered her depression and anxiety in the first place, obviously having her mother then pass away is just an incredibly traumatic event for someone who was, for anyone, frankly, but for someone who is already struggling so much, that's obviously going to set her back. And the insurer ignored it. Just completely ignored it as though it didn't happen. They just kept going forward with the plan that was in place, even when her treating doctors said very clearly, no, there's no way that she can be doing this. This is not appropriate. They completely ignored it. If you look through the claims file, there is a mention of it when they're first notified. And then it is not discussed again. It is never discussed in the planning for the return to work. It's never raised as a consideration. And when finally she says, well, no, I'm not going back to work. My doctor said I should not be doing it. They said, okay, well, we're cutting off your benefits as of, I think it was 4 weeks from that point in time. And that was that. So inertia can be a very, very powerful motivator for the, or force, I should say, for the insurance company. And it can be almost impossible to overcome unless and until you bring a legal claim. And we see that all the time. It defies logic. It defies reason. But there it is. That is very often what is behind decisions that don't seem to make a lot of sense.
Tamar?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not good at physics, so I don't know about it. You know, but I went to law school.
That's funny.
But I absolutely agree with what James is saying, which is once the insurance company's on a path, it's very difficult to deter them from that path, even when there is support that things have changed, because they don't want to contend with the change. They'd rather just continue to justify the closure of the claim, because they'd much rather see the closure of the claim. And perhaps, what do you do after that? Do you maybe feel forced to get back to work? Some people do, despite medical advice, and perhaps they get sick again or they can't sustain work. Alternatively, they don't work at all, but they're without their disability funds, right? Or there could be a midway situation. Either way, it releases the insurance company from the ongoing obligation to continue to pay your benefit. So by all means, most certainly, it's the opportunity there to bring a legal claim and argue with the insurance company. But if that situation is you, that's what's most frustrating, particularly where there's a mental health condition that recurs. And it's very typical for mental health conditions to recur. I'm not a doctor, like I said, but you know, there's a waxing and waning. There's a remitting and relapsing nature of mental health conditions in particular. And that's where I see a lot of this kind of thing that James is describing, which is insurance companies putting blinders on certain facts, certain elements of claims, and cherry picking what they want to use as the basis for the claim closure. So they will... You know, I spoke to a guy this week. They're putting words in my mouth tomorrow. I'm like, yeah, I can hear that, because they'll talk to you about what's your daily function. They'll assess, oh, well, you're going out of your house and going grocery shopping once a week because you need to eat. But that therefore must mean that you can go and do your office job. Those two things don't necessarily jive. So we do see a lot of this, you know, and the best way to protect from this, particularly in a mental health claim, is to have a lot of details contained in the reports and information that you're putting forth to the insurance company. Mental health in particular can be an invisible disease. We know that. We generally, as a society, have a lot more understanding around how these conditions work, but insurance companies have come a little ways, but not necessarily enough. And so what I recommend usually, as I did to the individual I was speaking with this week, is you kind of have to spoon feed it to the insurance company. Make sure that what you're saying to some extent is echoed by your doctors as well in the reports, in the medical notes, in the information they're supplying to the insurance company, because it makes it that much harder for them to ignore that information. And if they do, it makes it that much more difficult when we've got the legal claim to resist actually coming to the table and trying to resolve and settle the claim with us. Back to you, James.
Why don't we dig into some of the emails or questions?
You bet.
Sounds good.
This term, guys, health management consultant. What does it mean? And if you know, the insurer says they're having your file reviewed by a health management consultant, do you got to follow the recommendation?
Well, so health management consultant is an undefined term. It's not, nice. There is no College of Health Management Consultants. It's not a licensed profession. It is a term that is essentially made up by insurance companies. But typically, what it describes is someone who is usually an employee of the insurance company that is involved in the adjudication process at a point where there is question about the medical evidence in the file. It is usually actually not someone who they're relying on for medical opinion. Usually that is a medical consultant as opposed to health management consultant. The management part generally suggests that they are going to be involved in the direction that the insurer is going to require the person to go in order to continue receiving benefits. Often that will mean a particular treatment like a work hardening program. Sometimes it will involve having the file or the individual assessed by a medical consultant, which is another undefined term. Sometimes that means a doctor, sometimes it doesn't. But generally, a health management consultant is just someone that the insurer is relying on to direct what the person's going to have to do going forward in order to try and get them from disabled to back to work. So you have to follow their recommendations. Generally, as long as what they're recommending is reasonable, then yeah, that's going to be in your policy. You have to follow the reasonable advice and treatment recommendations. Now, they are not doctors. So if right. what they are recommending is not something that is medically appropriate, then no. But if your doctor looks at what they are suggesting and says, yeah, that's, you know, appropriate or at least not inappropriate, then you're probably going to have to follow those recommendations, because even if it's not strictly necessary, if you don't, your insurer is almost certainly going to cut you off. If they do recommend something that is inappropriate, that's why you have to have your doctors review any treatment recommendations, any recommendations that the insurer is making to you, to make sure that is something that isn't going to set you back. And if it is, you need to have your doctor provide something in writing that is very clearly addressing what is being requested of you, why it is inappropriate, and what should be done instead. And based on that, I would take the position that you're not going to comply. The insurer might still cut you off in that circumstance, but at least if they do, they can't say they weren't aware that it was inappropriate, and they're going to be exposed potentially to having to pay damages over and above what the benefits are worth as a result of forcing you to do that or cutting off your benefits because you did.
Tamar, I want to get your thought on this, but we got to take a short break. And when we do that, we'll get your thoughts and then flip it over to some emails. That is help@disabilityrights.ca. But reaching out here and now to the show to talk to us, 416-872-1010. You can text 71010 as well. Right here, Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
Yes, welcome back indeed. Reach out to Tamar or James when the show is done. Here's a couple different ways. Really simple. Phone number 1-855-821-5900. help@disabilityrights.ca. You can also use the website mydisabilityquestions.com. But here and right now, 416-872-1010 to call us on air. Text us 71010 as well. Tamar, we just left off with James giving his answer about the health management consultant. And if you're getting your file reviewed by them and following the recommendations set forth, what do you think about that?
I wholeheartedly agreed with James's, you know, response on that. I think that the key takeaway is that if you've got someone like this assigned to your claims file, and by the way, different insurers use different terms. They could be a rehab specialist or some other, you know, conception. Two things. Number one, it is most likely, as James said, someone who's hired by the insurance company. So this is, they've got a job to do. And usually the job is to try and get you back to work. So it's sort of the beginning of the end of the claim, in my mind, as a signal that if you've got this kind of a consultant or rehab specialist or someone else involved in your file that's not your claims adjuster, right? Not the person you've been dealing with day to day, then usually they have a job to do, which is to try and take the claim to the point of where they can recommend that you get back to work. So to echo what James has said, you know, you really do want to engage your own medical team in a situation like that to either endorse those recommendations or to provide further medical support that those recommendations don't make sense given where you're at from a health perspective. But that was really all I had to add, John. Maybe we tackle some emails.
Yeah, you bet. Jillian is up first. Thanks for emailing in, Jillian. Again, help at disabilityrights.ca says, guys, my LTD claim was denied. The reasoning is that the medical evidence does not support that your symptoms would have been present at a frequency and severity to result in a functional impairment that would interfere with your functional ability to perform your occupational duties. Therefore, the information does not support that you meet the definition. They acknowledge my symptoms and several illnesses, but then they say that my physician letter does not suffice. My doctor recommends 4 to 6 months more of time away from work to heal and to get stronger before I go back to work. Do I have a case?
All yours, Tamar.
So the first part of this email, Jillian, is quite technical. So for our listeners, you know, you will receive these letters that sometimes go on for 2 or 3 pages, maybe more, and they will include language like Jillian has provided to us about the frequency and severity that does not result in functional impairments. Well, what does that all mean? Well, to whittle it down, it means the insurance company thinks that you're just simply not sick enough, or your health is not poor enough to prevent you from returning back to work and doing the job that you were doing potentially before you stopped working, depending on how long Jillian's been off. Insurance companies are very focused on function. They will say, just because you've got symptoms or diagnoses, if those symptoms and diagnoses do not impact you to such a degree that it prevents you from actually being functional day to day or working, then we don't think that you should continue to qualify for ongoing disability benefits. This is why the devil is in so much of the details, because it certainly sounds like, from what Jillian has described to us, that her own doctors are recommending that she's not yet ready to work, that in fact she does remain functionally unable to continue working. And so, you know, where's the disconnect? I'd really want to see a little bit more about what else this letter says that Jillian has cited from, because I suspect that there's also a section just past this language that she's given us where the insurance company has to explain or justify, look, we've reviewed this medical information that your doctor has provided, and this is what we say about it. And if there isn't such information in the letter, then guess what? Yes, there is a basis for a legal claim. Certainly there's a basis for a legal claim even on its face, because if Jillian has the support from her doctors that she cannot work, in my mind, that's typically the end of the analysis. But what are the gaps? That's usually what I'm always looking for. So if there are gaps to fill, let's fill them. But either way, the insurance company should have the ongoing obligation to continue paying the disability benefit if your doctor is recommending that you still need more time to return back to work. What do you think, James?
Well, the part that I focus on in this email, and in fact in the letter that was sent to Jillian, is the language about frequency and severity of the symptoms. That's something that there's no frequency and severity defined in the policy. You're not going to see that. You're not going to see any language that says your symptoms have to be daily or constant or hourly or anything like that. It wouldn't make sense to do it that way. And so to say that they don't have the frequency and severity necessary to show sufficient impairment, I mean, it's just a really vague way of saying we don't think you're totally disabled. But there isn't generally a great way to show that. There are some insurers that will, not always, but sometimes, ask the treating doctors to fill out very detailed forms that get to that level of function so that they can actually make a real determination on how often the symptoms are arising, how serious they are, and how that impacts their ability to function. That's a real analysis, and that is something that a doctor can do if they are asked to do it and provided a reasonable means to do it. Doctors aren't just going to do that on their own. That's not the way that they normally work. That's not what their function normally is. They're not sitting there thinking, you know, how can I describe my patient's illness in such granular detail that anyone looking at it would be able to figure out what they can do? That's not usually their function. Their function is, how can I make you better? And so that's just not the way they're typically approaching these situations unless they're specifically asked. And most insurers don't do that very well. Sometimes I think that's quite deliberate. But if a doctor is saying that, you know, my patient can't work for the next 4 to 6 months, because of this particular disability, this illness, what have you, My view is, once you have that information, as long as there is some support in the clinical records, and there almost always is, it's then really on the insurer, if they're not satisfied with the level of detail there, to specifically ask and say, okay, well, you say he's not able to work. Why? What are the functional deficits here? How often is this happening? Why does this affect their job? There is, as far as I'm concerned, there is a positive obligation at that point for the insurer to seek out clarification if they're not going to accept the opinion of the treating doctor that is backed up by the clinical notes. And insurers never do that. If they don't get it initially, and they haven't sent that form to the doctor initially, they don't follow up, they simply just send a denial letter in language like this saying, oh, well, we haven't seen anything talking about the frequency and severity of the symptoms and how that impacts your ability to function. So sorry, you're denied, as though that information is something that is just automatically going to be given to them and people are going to know to do that. So it's a bit of a bugaboo of mine. It's something that gets my back up when I see that sort of language in the denial.
Want to move on to Bruce, guys. Got a couple minutes before we break, so we'll get to Bruce's email. It's a short one. Says, I receive LTD and I'm permanently disabled. I recently got arrested and charged with a criminal offense. Can the insurance company terminate my LTD because I have a criminal record?
Well, it's quite a topical question, given what we started the show with.
Yep.
So the answer is actually, you know, having the criminal record itself isn't really an issue. That you got arrested and charged with a criminal offense is really neither here nor there. The issue is, if you got disabled as a result of participation in a criminal offense, then the insurer is usually going to be able to deny based on the exclusions. And typically, there is also language in most policies that will allow the insurer to hold off paying benefits, to withhold benefits, I should say, for any period of time where you're incarcerated. So if while you are getting disability insurance, you're charged with an offense and you're imprisoned as a result of that, for the time that you are actually in jail, typically, I believe, the insurer would not have to pay. That doesn't necessarily end your claim, but it means that they don't have to pay you benefits while you are in prison. If you were released and still totally disabled, I believe you would have a claim that would allow you to continue getting benefits afterwards. It is, I will say, not a situation that comes up often, and certainly not one that has come up in my practice to date. But if it ever does, I will certainly share with our listeners how that argument goes.
Tamar, what do you think?
Agreed.
Done.
Full stop.
Guys, let's take a short break. Jackie, your email's up next. Thank you for sending that along. You can as well, and they will return your emails, by the way, when the show's not here, but we'll get to as many as we can with the remaining time of the show. Help at disabilityrights.ca, and just in case you want to make that phone call and talk to us in the next couple minutes, 416-872-1010. You can just text your question if you prefer, and that is 71010 as well. So there you go. More Disability Law Show is on the way, the Bell Talk Radio Network.
This is the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.
And welcome back. We still got a bit of time happening here, so you can contact us if you would like in the next few minutes, 416-872-1010 for a call. If not, that's fine. Text as well, 71010 might be quicker for you. If not, we're going to move on to another email. Jackie is up next. Says, hello, I'm on LTD after having two knee surgeries and cannot return to my daycare job. But during this time off, I was also diagnosed with severe neck stenosis and am in pain on entire right side, along with numbness. Can this condition, along with existing, be covered by insurance? Should I mention this to them? I am covered only under the original injury. Thank you.
Sounds familiar, John. It sounds very similar to the topic I was talking about at the top of the show, right? So, you know, you start off with one disability claim, as a result of certain health issues. And then while you are off, as it sounds like Jackie has been, she develops other health issues. Yes, Jackie, you absolutely should advise the insurance company of all ongoing health issues. Total disability under these disability policies can be established by a variety of health issues, not necessarily restricted to the original disability issue that you had that put you off work at the start. And the insurance company, by the way, is obligated to review all of the medical information. All of the issues that you have should be part of their ongoing analysis, adjudication, review of your claim. in order to assess whether you continue to meet the test of disability under the policy. In fact, you'd be doing yourself a great disjustice if you didn't include all the information to the insurance company, because if the insurance company is perhaps in this path that James was talking about before, this inertia, and they don't have the benefit of this additional information, it can be that much more difficult then. Look, we will present it as part of a legal claim, but my point being that it's better that they have this information and still continue on the path. And so we can then keep them honest, saying, well, hang on, there's nothing in the policy that says that just because you start off with one disability or health issue, that you're disability isn't persisting and therefore continuing to be valid and to be payable if you develop other health issues along the way. So no, I would say you're not necessarily just covered for the original health issue. And this can, of course, exist whether it's a physical disability, mental health disability, or some combination of the two. What do you think, James?
Well, I think the question speaks to a common misperception about what disability law really is. A lot of people get trapped under the line of thinking that disability insurance is there if you have a particular disability that is preventing you from working. That's not really what it is. What it is if you have a collection of symptoms that are impacting your function sufficiently that you can't keep working. That sometimes could be a singular injury. It could be you're in a car accident, you become a quadriplegic. Yes, of course, that is an easy way to, you know, see A to B and there you go. But it can also just be a collection of chronic illnesses and conditions that accumulate over time that prevent you from working. Or it could be a physical issue combined with a psychological issue or several psychological issues. The point of the matter is, the analysis is about what is your functional ability and what are your limitations due to medical issues. It doesn't have to be singular. And so if your functional ability is limited because of a medical issue, your insurer needs to know that, whether or not it's something that was already limiting you or whether it's new. It's just about your medical condition and how that impacts your ability to function. My hope is that in explaining this, I've made it clearer and not more complicated. I'm not 100% sure I've accomplished that, but hopefully if you're listening, that made some sense.
I'll ask you a question, guys. If someone's disability claim is denied because it was submitted a little bit late, the insurance company, do they have any options?
Yeah, you really do. And I want to make a very clear distinction here, though, because oftentimes on this show or on our TV show, we're talking about limitation periods, which is different than an application deadline. So when you are applying for disability insurance at the outset, you're injured or you have an illness and you're not able to work anymore and you have disability insurance, you apply for it with your insurance company by filling out some forms. The policy will have an application deadline. It's often something like 60 or 90 days. And if you are not within that time period when you apply for your benefits, the insurer will often initially take the position that you are not entitled to bring your claim. You're not entitled to apply anymore because you missed that deadline. That's really not a position they're entitled to take in most cases. Generally, the courts give a fair bit of leeway. It's called relief from forfeiture, but you don't really have to know that. The reality is, as long as your application isn't exceedingly late, and if the insurer has the ability to review your claim without being prejudiced in their ability to understand what's happening, then a court is almost always going to allow you to apply even if it's late. That doesn't mean you're going to be approved, but it means that you're at least going to be allowed to apply even if you're a little late. Now, don't take this as license to just miss the deadline and apply whenever. You don't want to have the fight if you can avoid it. And more to the point, you want the process to start earlier. Because if you're approved, you want to get those benefits sooner. And if you're denied, you want to be able to bring your claim earlier so that you can get your resolution earlier. But if you are late on the application, there are ways around it. Even if you're quite late, you should give us a call to let us know. Now, I started this answer by comparing it to the limitation period for bringing a legal claim. That is very, very different. So we were just talking about the application deadline. The other limitation period is if you are cut off or denied benefits. from the date that you get the letter from the insurance company that advises you that you are not getting benefits or are no longer going to be receiving benefits at some date in the future, there is a clock that starts running. And after 2 years from the date you get that letter, you're no longer entitled to bring a legal claim. And if you miss that two-year deadline, from the date you're denied or cut off, there is almost never anything that can be done about it. So you cannot miss that deadline. When you're denied your benefits or cut off, call us right away. Right away, and we got to get it started as soon as possible. You don't want to miss that deadline, or there's nothing you can do.
Tamar, what do you think?
Well, I agree with James's distinction, and I think that what I want to get across to individuals is to think about two questions. If your application is late, I'm not talking about the limitation period. So if your application is late, think about why is it late and how late is it? Those are the two questions I always ask myself, because if it's late because, for example, maybe your employer didn't provide sufficient advice around when you're supposed to apply, that's one issue. If it's late because you were hospitalized for a period of time and physically could not apply, that's another issue. Either way, I think those could be potentially legitimate reasons to challenge the insurance company that your claim is late. We're not even going to look at the disability part. We're just saying it's late, it's a technical decline, and they're declining on that basis. Those, if there's a sufficient reason for the delay, and that reason is reasonable, the court will forgive individuals if their claim is late. But there are limits. And so I agree with James wholeheartedly. Don't take this as an opportunity to be late intentionally or just be like, I can just put it in 6 months from now. No, you should be diligent about putting in that claim. But think about why it was late. Can you offer the insurance company a reason? And how late are we talking about? I can recall one, John and James, where the lateness was something like 17 days. Like it was ridiculously short. Yeah. And the insurance company didn't even bother looking at the disability, the underlying disability claim, and simply use the technical period where this individual should have applied and use that as the basis to decline the claim. And this individual had specifically a really good reason for it. That is not going to withstand the scrutiny of a court. We would start a legal claim in a situation like that and keep the insurance company honest to have those benefits paid ultimately.
Guys, been one heck of a day. We're just about out of time, though, so I'm going to give you some contact to reach out to James and Tamar at the firm anytime. By the way, Samfiru Tamark, and the most positively reviewed disability law firm in the land. Here's the number, 1-855-821-5900. Email address we use every show is helpdisabilityrights.ca, and I did mention a place where you can also ask some questions anonymously and see if it's already been asked, and then save yourself some time. If not, leave it there, and it will get answered in depth. MyDisabilityQuestions.com. And there you go. And also some little notes, some little FAQs can be had at ltdfaq.ca. So there's no shortage of ways to contact James and Tamar and the respective teams. Until next time, this has been the Disability Law Show on the Bell Talk Radio Network.